Today we've got a great lecture. It's my sincere pleasure to introduce Dr. Richard Davey, who is the Director of Transfusion Medicine at Methodist Hospital. Dr. Davey graduated from Dartmouth College as well as the University of Rochester School of Medicine. He then completed his residencies at the University Hospitals at Cleveland and at Georgetown University Hospital. When you look at his CV, you realize how little you've done in comparison to some other people. He is certified in internal medicine, hematology in internal medicine, and pathology with emphasis on transfusion. He's spent the majority of his career at the National Institute of Health, where actually an annual lectureship has been formed in immunohematology and blood transfusion in his name. Dr. Davey has worked with the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, to assist developing countries in developing transfusion medicine. He was chief medical officer of the American Red Cross and recently was chief of the New York Blood Center, where he was in charge of blood management for the entire metropolitan area of New York. Dr. Davey has published over 100 papers as well as textbooks chapters, and his lecture today will cover recent advances in transfusion medicine. Dr. Davey.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. It's good to be here today. We're going to talk about a number of topics in the field of transfusion medicine today, a little bit about blood donation, some issues about blood safety, and then finish up with maybe some innovations about artificial blood. Before I start, can everybody hear me in the back okay? That's good. Actually, I was giving a lecture one day, and I asked that question, and a bunch of people in the back said no. And wouldn't you know it, 25 people in the front got up and moved to the back, which really was not encouraging at all, but I'm glad we're okay for that. Okay, so we'll talk, just to look at the talk a little bit in the way we're going to organize it, just a few facts about blood donation in the United States. And then we're going to talk about transfusion-transmitted diseases, what people worry about, and what are really the issues these days in terms of transfusion safety, looking at bacteria and platelets, and maybe some opportunities or pathogen inactivation of the blood supply. Then we're going to talk about transfusion safety in the hospital. Big issue, this hospital and any hospital. Looking at trolley, transfusion-associated lung injury, TACO, transfusion-associated circulatory overload, and yes, ABO errors. Actually, that's the number one cause of problems in the hospital these days, or mismatched blood. So we'll talk about that a bit. And then look at an innovation both that's been incorporated in Europe and Canada and here at this hospital now, the transfusion safety officer. Then we'll finish up with some comments about artificial blood, better called maybe red cell substitutes, to see if that holds much promise for the future in terms of transfusion medicine. So what about blood donation in the United States today? Where are we in terms of this country and blood donation? Well, we have about, out of 300 million people, we have about 8 million volunteers. Not so great when you think we have 300 million. First-time donors, about 15 to 25%. We really like to see repeat donors in the blood supply. They're the ones that are lifelong donors, have been screened many times, but everyone's a first-time donor once, for sure. And people average about 1.6 donations a year, resulting in about 12.5 million units of blood. The autologous use of autologous blood and directed blood is declining. I think that's a good idea. That's a wasteful product, a wasteful process. We throw a lot of blood away. We really don't need to do much of that anymore, and I'd like to see both of those percentages decline. So we had about 11.5 million units of red cells, and we all know, we're in the field of medicine, blood transfusion, blood components are just absolutely critical for modern medicine. We're not going to talk about component therapy or blood utilization today. That's maybe another talk, but it's clear we couldn't have modern surgery, oncology, hematology without blood transfusion as we know it. So about, we feel that about 55% of the population can actually donate blood. Right age, hemoglobin's okay, no other deferrals. But when you know it, only about 2.5 to 4.5% actually do donate blood. So we have shortages. And even today here in Methodist, we're short of blood. We've had to shuffle surgeries around. And things are just not, the blood supply has always been marginal. And more than I'd like to see, we have to give Rh-positive red cells to Rh-negative individuals. You can do that once, but then they get sensitized and you can't do that down the road. So it's not a good practice. But that's kind of where we are in terms of blood donation. So I'll say it now, I'll say it at the end. We need blood donors. Please donate blood. Ask your family, ask your friends, ask your patients to step up and donate blood. So that's a little bit about donation. We're going to spend most of the time on the recipient end of transfusion. So what are the risks of transfusions? What do people think about when they say, okay, what do we worry about when we transfuse blood? We ask the man on the street, he's probably going to say HIV, right? HIV, AIDS, that's the problem, maybe hepatitis. And yes, the next man on the street is going to say the same thing. He might even say, I'm worried about catching HIV from donating blood. That's been a problem, actually. I think that fear is lessened, but some people are actually concerned about contracting a disease from donating blood. This is not a survey, but you might ask folks in the hospital what they are concerned about, and they might say, well, hives and reactions, maybe hepatitis. But actually, the risk of transfusions are quite different than I think what many of us perceive these days. This is one of the great success stories in medicine. If you look at this slide from my friend Harvey Alter at NIH, if we look at over the last 45 years, the incidence of post-transfusion hepatitis, and you can say the same thing about post-transfusion HIV, it's been a dramatic success. If you look back in the late 60s at NIH when they were transfusing a lot of blood for the early heart lung machines, 25% of those people got hepatitis, 25%. Then we moved to an all-volunteer blood supply. The first hepatitis B surface antigen test was implemented. That was a dramatic reduction. Then through the 80s, as all these tests, big ones being the first HIV test, then HCV, the first HCV test, and all the other improvements on those tests, were all synergistic. So right now, the risk of HIV and the hepatitis C are almost unmeasurable, 1 in 2 million, 1 in 3 million. Incredible safety story right there. So we're worried now not about these diseases, HIV and HCV, but diseases of much lower incidence like Chagas disease and mad cow. So let's look at those for a second. Chagas disease. This is a disease that's been endemic in South America for many years. They've used gentian violets in the blood to kill the parasite. Blue blood, it's blue blood they've been transfusing. Now there's a better test. But it's an issue, especially with immigration from these countries to the U.S. And there have been 8 cases of transfusion-transmitted Chagas in North America. It's probably underreported. Actually, if you look at seroprevalence in some of the immigrant populations, we should be seeing a little more of it than we are. It's a little puzzle. But there is a test. It's just been licensed in the past month or two, and it's probably going to be implemented across the country for the blood supply. Again, a very expensive test for a fairly minor public health menace, probably $10 a pop for every unit of blood for this extra test, but we're going to have to see that happening. There's the Trypanosoma cruzi organism, and there is the bug, the kissing bug, that is the vector for the disease, ugly little critter. But that's a guy that lives in the thatched roofs of some of these poor homes down in Central and South America. West Nile virus, again, this is a quick cruise through some of the problems that we had. Some mosquito probably flew off an airplane in Kennedy Airport in 1999, started a little epidemic around the Bronx, and it West Nile virus, which has been a virus we've known about for years in other countries, and it stayed in mid-Atlantic for a couple of years, and then, as probably most of us know, it's exploded in this country, moving to the Midwest in 2002, Rocky Mountain 2003, now it's on the West Coast, and it is transmitted by blood transfusion. It can happen. Most folks who contract this disease don't even know they had it. 80% of the folks are good to go, develop an antibody, no problem. That's good for them, but it's not too good for blood donation because they can transmit that virus when they're viremic. And about 1 in 150 people, immunosuppressed, can get a very serious meningeal encephalitis that can be fatal. A good story, the corporations and the blood community developed the test very rapidly, and we have a very effective nucleic acid test in place. Blood supply is safe in terms of West Nile virus. Malaria. We don't have a good test for malaria. What we rely on there is donor questions. Those of you who donate blood know the questions you have to go through. We're working with the FDA to modify these questions because right now, if you get off a cruise boat in Cancun and go see a Mayan temple for a day, you're deferred for a year. And we'd much rather see, and we have data to support this, that the restrictions only be for people who've lived in or resided extensively in endemic countries. If we can just get rid of the Mexico traveler thing, we'd get a lot more donors in here. But well, that's an FDA issue. Babesiosis, not a problem here in Texas, but it is a problem in Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, and Cape Cod area. It's a tick-borne disease, about 40 cases, transfusion transmitted. Interesting abstract, actually, on this. This is a real abstract. They correlated babesiosis and other tick-borne diseases with golf handicap. And it turns out, it does turn out that these guys who are on the weeds looking for lost golf balls do get bitten by ticks. And sure enough, they have a higher prevalence of these tick-borne diseases. I'm glad I don't play golf up there. I'd be at grave risk. And that's the Babesia organism, which is looks a little bit like malaria, but has this ring-shaped. Mad cow disease. Okay, this has been an issue with the blood supply. Here's a chart looking at the onset of definite or probable cases of variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or the human variety of mad cow disease. These are almost all in the United Kingdom. We now have about 155 cases worldwide of VCJD, almost all in the UK, a handful in France, a couple in Italy. This is a UK problem for cows and for people. And you can see that the disease has really been tapering off. I think there were 5 cases in 2005. But we don't know a lot about it. The incubation period, prions are a very mysterious protein, another lecture, but it's an issue. And it's really, this disease has really impacted the blood supply because of the restrictions. There are now 3 cases of probable VCJD transmitted by blood, all in the UK. We'd hope there wouldn't be any, but it looks like there are 3. These have popped up in recipients of blood, people from donors who were good donors, donated blood, then subsequently came down with VCJD. We've been following their transfusion recipients. 3 of them look like they've contracted a disease. So it looks like it can happen. The restrictions, though, are draconian. I won't go through all the different permutations. They're kind of complex. But basically, we've disqualified all 300 million Europeans from donating blood in the U.S. and many, many Americans who've traveled or resided in Europe. It really hurt New York because, sadly, New York, we haven't been able to supply our own population. And New York City had to import blood from FDA-licensed volunteer donors from Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands. That all got stopped. So we have lost about 700,000 donors. That's over 1 million donations per year. These are donations last every year. In my view, it's not safe not to have enough blood. It's not safe to run out of blood. And I would much prefer if we drew a bright line around the United Kingdom and restricted donation from that country only and not all this other stuff. But again, that's the FDA requirement. Actually, Japan, excuse me, Japan, they actually for a while said if you were in the United Kingdom for one day, you're deferred for life. So if you were at Heathrow and had a Wimpy Burger, you're deferred for life. Now, they've backed off a little on this, but it got to be that extreme. And we're really hammering the blood supply with some of these restrictions. This is a message from the American Cow Association. So, okay, we're going the wrong way. Okay, so the problems are not HIV, hepatitis, and mad cow. The big 3 in terms of transfusion, morbidity, and mortality are bacterial contamination of platelets, trolley, and ABO mismatches. So let's look at those 3. First, bacterial contamination of platelets. Why is this a problem? Well, those of you that are familiar with how we store blood realize we have to store platelets at room temperature. Can't store them in the cold like we can red cells because they don't work. The von Willebrand's flat factor clusters and they get these activated platelets get quickly swept out of the circulation. So you have to keep them at room temperature for only 5 days. What a good medium for growing organisms, right? and it happens. We do get gram-negative organisms sometimes in these platelet packs. You get a bag of endotoxin, and if that gets transfused, it can be immediately fatal, and it has been. It's not like HIV, which is bad enough for people who live with HIV. You can die immediately with a bag of endotoxin transfused, and it's an issue. If you actually culture platelets, you do find bacteria in quite a few, mostly inconsequential, don't cause problems. We think the fatality rate, though, before we started culturing apheresis platelets, maybe 1 in 40,000. Unclear, but certainly up there. Contamination, skin flora, and donor bacteremia, about half and half. Skin flora, actually, it's interesting. It's the repeat donors that seem to be probably a little more risk because you get all scarred up and kind of little crypts in the antecubital fossa from being stuck all the time, and they might harbor bacteria in there. Donor bacteremia, maybe a hidden abscess. There have been donors with subclinical ostio that have donated, and that can cause a problem. So what are we doing? Well, better donor histories. We really can't ask, are you septic today? That doesn't work too well. But we do take people's temperature and ask them if they're well. I don't think we can do too much more. We are looking at, we've improved skin disinfection in the last few years. We're actually, in this hospital, we're going to be moving from alcohol iodine to chlorhexidine because some people are allergic to iodine. Diversion pouches. We have to take about 30 ml for blood testing, so why not take the first 30 ml, which is where you might get skin bacteria, and use that for testing. And so we divert the first 30 ml of a whole blood donation into a pouch and use that for testing, and that reduces skin flora contamination. We do have a problem, though, with whole blood-derived platelets or whole blood platelets because we have to pool, as you probably know, pool 4 to 6 units of platelets derived from whole blood into a pool to make it a useful product. The FDA says you got to do that within 4 hours of transfusion, so we can't culture it. There's no time. We have to use pH, look for pH drops, glucose drops, very poor screening criteria. We can culture apheresis platelets. Right after donation, it's a single donation, we can culture it. This is a BacT-Alert incubator. So single donor apheresis platelets, for many reasons, I think are preferred. Here's a study from Hopkins that supports that. Many years ago, Paul Ness at Hopkins decided at that institution they're going to move all completely to apheresis platelets. And over the 12 years, they went from half apheresis platelets, half whole blood-derived pool platelets, to almost 100% apheresis platelets. Very good. And they did see septic reactions decrease from about 1 in 5,000 to 1 in 15,000, about one-third. So it really works. So you might ask, why don't we switch right away to all apheresis platelets? I wish we could. The donation for apheresis platelets is a little bigger deal. It takes 45 minutes. We don't have enough donors. And they're more expensive. It's about twice as expensive for an apheresis pack to buy it from Gulf Coast or a whole blood derived pack. So it's an economic and a donor issue. But that's a direction we really need to be moving, both here and across the country. Apheresis technology has really improved a lot. These are just a couple instruments. This is the Baxter Alex. This is the Gambro Tremo SL. These are slick instruments. They're user-friendly, they're patient-friendly, donor-friendly. You can mix and match what you need on these instruments. If you need platelets, you can get platelets. If you need red cells, you can get red cells. Mix and match it. These are great instruments. I recommend everyone to become an apheresis donor. I've done it many times. I'm still standing. It's a really an easy thing to do. And it's no trouble to fix these things up. You put the tubing in here, you wheeze it around here, through this filter here, around the centrifuge, and it comes out here. And it's no problem. Actually, that's why we have skilled technologists doing this for us. But apheresis, this is another talk. Apheresis technology has really improved so much that it's been very valuable, not only for donation, but for therapeutics. Therapeutic apheresis, TTP, Guillain-Barré, myasthenia gravis, sickle cell disease. I got to say, with Chris Levesque and our team here at Methodist, it's one of the finest therapeutic apheresis units in the country. And we really do a lot of good work with these instruments. Stem cell harvesting, helps supporting our oncologic colleagues with stem cells for transplantation. And as I've alluded to, I'd like to see in 10 years, every donor walking the door going on one of these instruments. We need O red cells. We can get double red cells. You can get 2 units of red cells now and 1 sitting on one of these instruments. If you're an AB donor, we need your plasma. So we get plasma. If you're A, how about some platelets? Or red cells and platelets. we can really target the donor for the need depending on their blood type and the needs of the hospital. That's where we're going. Okay, we talked about all these viruses and Chagas and bacterium platelets, things we can do about them. How about killing everything right from the beginning by putting something into a bag of blood that inactivates all pathogens? Good idea. And boy, people have been working on this. They have probably expended $1 billion, if not more, looking at these technologies. All of them really relate to one kind of basic principle. They're intercalators, chemicals, other compounds that intercalate in nucleic acid. They dock, and either through UV elimination or a pH reaction, they cross-link the DNA. So this is locked. It won't replicate. You don't want things replicating in a unit of blood most of the time. So all pathogens are inactivated. And it works. There are a couple, some companies that have been looking at this. Cirrus is one of the major ones. They've developed some compounds called sorolins. It's a basic sorolin. Their compound is called S59. And they've looked at platelets and plasma with this. And it really inactivates pathogens very well. It also damages platelets. You lose about 20% of platelets, which isn't so good. And they have to remove it with another process. So it's kind of cumbersome. But it does work. Another company called Navigen is looking at actually riboflavin, good old vitamin B2. That works the same way, too. There's vitamin B2. And both of these technologies, you have to put the material in, and then you have to use these flat bags and then put it in a UV light box and let the UV light irradiate it. It works, but when you think of doing this up on mass scale, it's kind of a problem. Also, you can't use UV light with red cells. Those bags are just too opaque. So another compound called, these are frangible linker effector compounds. Cirrus has been looking at this. They had a problem, though, a big problem about 3 years ago with neoantigen and autoantibody formation against treated red cells really set them back. So if you can't get the red cells straightened out, using this material on platelets and plasma may not be, if you do it on one component and not another, does it make a lot of sense? So the pros of pathogen inactivation are it inactivates pathogens. That's great. But cons are you're going to lose a lot of products. It's going to be a problem scaling up to large scale. It's toxic, and it's going to cost an arm and a leg when these things are finally approved. So it's one of those issues coming down the pike. So the risks are not really, did the wrong thing. Forward. Okay, the risks are really not HIV. If we look at the risk per unit, not, as we've seen, not HIV, HCV, HBV, certainly not VCJD. Bacterium platelets we're handling. The bigger risk, as I've mentioned, are mistransfusion and trolley. So let's look at those. How about trolley? Transfusion-associated acute lung disease, an issue that we're becoming more familiar with. It's most commonly reported to cause of transfusion-related mortality. It's probably underreported, at least 100 cases a year. And sounds like we have the kids channel on the other one. But basically, these folks develop a mild to severe hypoxic lung injury following transfusion, 2 to 6 hours after transfusion. And you get this pulmonary edema-like picture. Usually, if these folks are diagnosed properly and treated, it resolves within 96 hours. There's really no residual that we know about from this particular problem. We really don't know the incidence because many of these people are sick. They have other problems with acute lung injury that might complicate the diagnosis. But if it isn't treated properly, it can really cause significant mortality. How is it caused? Well, we think that all trolley is immune-mediated and involves both a priming event and probably an activation event. There are two really mechanisms that we think are in place. One is we would call the HLA mechanism, where HLA class 1 or class 2 antibodies are in donor plasma. Okay, donor plasma, HLA antibodies. A lot of women who've had pregnancies have HLA antibodies. And they react, if they react against a concordant antigen in the recipient, you're going to have neutrophil activation and sequestration in the pulmonary vasculature. The other mechanism that we think might be happening here is what we call a two-hit mechanism, where these folks are sick, who are going to be transfused in, say, an ICU. There are already inflammatory cytokines around. The pulmonary endothelium is kind of primed. Neutrophils are primed. You transfuse some old blood that has interleukins in there, maybe some other biologic response modifiers. That's going to trigger this reaction, even without a specific antibody involved. If we look at this diagrammatically, the antigen antibody reaction is one arm, neutrophil activation, endothelial damage, pulmonary edema. The two-hit mechanism, you have infection, surgery, and inflammation with prime neutrophils. You get biologic substances in a transfused product, same pathway, pulmonary edema. So in both instances, we have neutrophil activation and lung damage. The complicating factor is often this occurs in very sick people, other reasons for lung injury. So we're trying to get algorithms to look at possible trolley, probable trolley, when it's trolley, when it's something else. Sometimes it's easy. In this case, this particular physician was worrying about it. But luckily, on the X-ray, there was a nice big sign that said, this is indeed trolley. And this guy cleverly made the diagnosis by pointing it. Here's an interesting case. Look at this case. This is an instance where there was trolley that occurred in a person with a single lung transplant. 34-year-old woman, 10 weeks after a right lung transplant, transfused with some red cells, developed dyspnea, O2 desaturation. And that's the transplanted lung. That's her normal lung. Pretty dramatic demonstration of trolley in a transplanted lung. And if you look at the HLA situation here, things match up. If you look at the donor, the blood donor for that implicated unit, there was an anti-HLA B24 in that plasma. Patient didn't have that HLA type, but the lung donor did. So the anti-HLA B24 reacted with that right lung, causing that whiteout of the right lung. Pretty dramatic. So what should we do about this? Anything we can do? Should we test everyone for HLA? Kind of expensive. How about restricting plasma donations from all women? You may have read about this in the lay press. People are saying you don't want women's blood anymore. Well, this is an issue right now in this country and in elsewhere, as we'll see. We might have to do this. And it isn't that plasma from women it can't be used. It can be put into a fractionation process so we can make IVIG and factor VIII and other things. But it might be a good idea to restrict FFP transfusion to males, from males only, from male donors only. And actually, we can do this. 7 million of the 12 million donors in the U.S. are males. We use about 4.5 million units of FFP. So it's just a logistic issue to get all that FFP from males. Other things we can do, that have been proposed, you can see all women in transfused men or just women who've been pregnant, screen for HLA antibodies, et cetera, et cetera. But it looks like what we're going to be doing is restricting FFP to donations from males only. Does it work? Well, in the UK, they've been doing this since 2003. And they're really over 90% now of FFP in the UK is from males only. Their experience has shown that trolley, at least the reported possible trolleys, have decreased somewhat. But if you look after they've evaluated them as a likely trolley, there's been a significant drop. And if you look at the FFP transfusions in the likely cases, they've gone from 8 to 1. Small numbers, but certainly suggestive that moving away from female plasma is a good idea. American Red Cross has looked at this in their experience. From over a three-year period, they had 72 suspected trolley fatalities. And they worked up 38 very extensively, serologically, and 17 of those 38 had HLA or human neutrophil antibodies. So they feel that they could have interdicted 17 fatalities if they had used male-only plasma. And they are now moving pretty extensively, and already have done that, to male-only plasma. It's going to happen everywhere. So ladies, we love your red cells, and the plasma is going the right way, and platelets, but not for FFP anymore. Also, we need to use FFP less. That'll help, for sure. It's inappropriate sometimes. What about trolley versus transfusion-associated circulatory overload? We've seen that trolley is a permeability edema, and circulatory overload is a hydrostatic edema from over-transfusion. Very hard to tell apart sometimes. The lungs white out, you give transfusions, people get short of breath. Very hard to differentiate. The pulmonary wedge, CVP, we don't use too much anymore. They're invasive. The BMP may indeed be helpful, but it's not very stat test. So it's very hard to differentiate these sometimes. The Mayo Clinic, they looked at, see if they could differentiate between trolley and TACO. They looked at about 9,000 at-risk transfusions in about 1,350 patients. These patients were defined as at risk because they didn't have any other pulmonary risk factors. So they were at risk for transfusion-associated problems, if you will. And they found that there were 94 patients developed respiratory failure within 6 hours of transfusion. 45 were found to have other problems like obstruction or aspiration. 49 had confirmed pulmonary edema. They thought of those 49, 24 had really a trolley-looking picture. And then further evaluation, they thought 14 were possible trolley, 7 were probable trolley. Again, hard to differentiate. But 25 were thought to be transfusion overload. So about half and half trolley and TACO. Half and half trolley and TACO. I mean, you can look at it. If you've transfused someone with 4 or 5 units in the past 6 hours and they get short of breath, you might think of TACO. It's probably more prevalent than trolley, but very tough. We'll try to help you out when these diagnoses come up on the floor. So trolley, some conclusions. It's not recognized. It's underdiagnosed. There's the pathogenic mechanisms are not really well understood. We need better methods to distinguish trolley from TACO. BNP may be helpful if we can make that a more stat test. We're going to be excluding plasma for transfusion from female donors. That's going to help, but it's not going to eliminate the risk. And FFP is used inappropriately a lot. If we can cut that back, that's step one to help diminish the risk of trolley. So the big three, we've looked at bacterial contamination of platelets. We've looked at transfusion-related acute lung injury. What about ABO errors? Let's look at that one. If we look at the transfusion fatalities reported to the FDA, everything's underreported here, but you can see the trolley has become more kind of aware of it, has increased. Bacteria, because of better culturing of apheresis platelets, is decreasing. ABO errors, about 10 to 15 fatalities a year, no change really over the last several years. Okay, well, can this happen here? Is this a big problem? Well, it is kind of a big problem. There was a study done by the BEST group, international group, looking at these issues. They looked at 70,000 blood bank samples in 62 hospitals, 10 different countries. They're all developed countries. And the data are a little bit scary to me. Mislabeled specimens. These are labeling, the labels are in error, not initialed properly, not dated properly. 1 in 162 samples mislabeled. Even more scary to me is almost 1 in 2,000 tubes of blood has the wrong blood in it. Somebody else's blood is in that tube with it, wrong blood in tube. Well, 1 in 2,000. That's very hard. We can't figure that out. If blood comes to the lab, that it's somebody else's blood in there and just misdrawn. In New York, there was a 10-year survey looking at erroneous ABO transfusions. As we'll see, not all ABO transfusions are clinically harmful. They can be compatible transfusions. But they've, the medical director of the New York State Department of Health looked at all erroneous transfusions, ABO, by 1 in 12,000, and incompatible transfusions by 1 in 38,000. Now, you can look at those numbers any way you want, but since this can be fatal, and these are things that we can interdict, these are issues now that are very current. Compare that to an HIV risk of 1 in 3 million, and you can see the different magnitude that we're talking about. CAP, another related study by CAP, they did a bedside check, and over 4,000 observed transfusions. The proper bedside check was not performed in 25%. Didn't do it. Didn't check it out. Didn't check the wristband. Didn't read the stuff. So you know, we can flog the staff as much as we can, but we got to do it. You have to follow procedure. You just have to follow procedure as best as we can to avoid this stuff. In England, the Serious Hazards of Transfusion Study looked at all the different ways that transfusion hazards can occur. And look at that. Two-thirds of the time in this study, it was the incorrect blood transfused was the problem. Trolley was there for sure, other transfusion reactions. Two-thirds of the time, people got the wrong blood, wrong stuff. So, on these ABO mismatches, are they always bad, or can we be lucky? And indeed, two-thirds of the time, we kind of are lucky. If you walked up to the blood bank now, blindfolded, grabbed a pint of blood, took it up to your patient, transfused it, two-thirds of the time, no harm done. You just pick out a compatible or an identical unit. I don't recommend it, but but two-thirds of the time, it'll be fortuitous because it'll be the right way. I mean, remember, this is not all the possible combinations. This is med school 101. But you can get away if Jones's blood is in the tube and Smith is O, and they're both O's, there you go. You give O to an A, O is a universal donor. Probably not a problem. B to an AB, there's no anti-B. Not a problem, A to an A. So two-thirds of the time, you're going to be lucky. And actually, we were lucky in this hospital last week, a couple weeks ago. We were lucky. There was an A to an A mistransfusion. What's not okay are these other issues. You give A to an O, okay? You're running into naturally occurring antibodies. In this case, the worst situation is A to an O because O people make not only anti-A, but a very potent anti-A comma B. It's an IgG antibody, very potent. It hemolyzes these cells immediately after transfusion. So you give A blood to an O person, that blood hemolyzes immediately with pretty bad damage to kidneys, hypertension shock, often death. Other mismatches are, as you note, all bad situations, but they occur. Well, certainly doesn't happen in this hospital, doesn't happen in Texas Medical Center area. Well, it does, I'm afraid. In the past 6 months, local area hospitals, I've known of three cases of A2O mistransfusion. We're not counting compatible transfusions or ones that are maybe less hazardous, A to an O, three times. So in the first instance that I'm aware of, there was a correct label on the tube. Actually, most of these issues are not problems in the blood bank. They're problems on the floors. In this case, the correct label is on the tube. The blood was in a properly labeled bag. Sure enough, it went to the OR, just hung in the wrong patient. A to an O, patient got sick, survived. Second case, wrong blood in the tube. The patient, the blood was drawn from patient X, who was type A, but labeled for patient Y, who was type O. So the blood came down to the tube came down to the blood bank, type A blood in it, blood set up for type A, and given and transfused to patient Y, who was type O. Patient became ill. The reaction really wasn't noted properly by the floor staff. Second unit of A was given 24 hours later. Patient became more ill. The reaction was noted. It was an elderly patient, probably didn't have a very high titer of anti-A, and the patient survived. Last case, six units of properly prepared type A red cells for patient X were sent in a cooler when called for by the OR, and this poor patient fell off the gurney and went right in. But, this blood went up. Patient Y was in the OR at the time. There had been a switch. Same procedure, actually. Six units of A blood was given to this O patient under anesthesia. The patient was very sick, but the patient died. So it can happen here, and really we need to avoid it. What are the options that we can look at? Well, we can look to technology. As we know, we can barcode our groceries. We use radio chips when we get into the parking garage. We certainly have been looking at all this stuff here at many hospitals and at Methodist, they are the wave of the future. Barcoding can be used. There are issues actually with a curvature that can interfere with this, but barcoding is one way to look. Radio frequency smart tags with smart tag reading bracelets are a possibility. Wi-Fi technology. Our colleagues at Dartmouth put the blood bags in another blood bag, a covering cellophane bag with a lock on it. And there was a three-number code on the patient's wristband, and you have to dial in the unlock code to get the bag out of the bag. And that works a good bit of the time, but surgeons have been known in a hurry just to cut the other bag off. So, you know, there's always ways around it. Actually, we're going to have a demonstration here next. This is kind of interesting. It's a company's making this instrument that's like a Coke dispenser. You can put it in the ICU or the OR, and with proper identification, the right unit of blood comes out like a can of Diet Coke. I mean, I don't want to make light of it. It's really pretty slick. It's a rapid turnaround. That's why there's a stopwatch. They claim they can get a unit of blood out in 60 seconds, and you don't have to get it back and forth to the blood bank. A possibility. These things all cost money. So the human interventions that have been tried are dedicated phlebotomists, people only targeted at drawing blood, pluses and minuses there with personnel issues and et cetera, and cost. At UCLA, they require every new patient to get two samples drawn because it's a new patient, so when you don't have a record in the blood bank that are at kind of risk. The problem there is if you really want to implement this with clarity, if you just have one sample, you don't have the second sample, you really got to give O-negative blood until you have the second sample. We don't have enough O-negative blood to do that. We're always short. So we're looking at a transfusion safety officer, that has been an innovation, not so innovative in other countries. We know that most hazards, as we've seen, occur outside the laboratory. The transfusion safety officer will work outside the laboratory to improve patient safety during transfusions. Where there are TSOs, these folks have been often nurses, not necessarily. About 3 years or so of med-surg experience are a good thing. And they're widely employed in Europe and Canada. In France, they're called hemovigilance people. And there are 2,000 of them in a country one-fourth our size. 2,000 hemovigilance inspectors, same in Canada. We're way behind the eight ball here. We have pharmacy officers, infection control officers. We need transfusion safety officers. I'm really delighted that Mark Boehm and Roberta Schwartz and others have supported hiring one here at Methodist Hospital. We're going to have one in a very short time. So very briefly, these TSOs can do a lot of good. They can address sample integrity so we don't get the wrong blood in the tube. Help us look at transfusion reactions. Focus on our audits and on sample collection and blood administration. Work with the transfusion committee and spiff up our staff training and education. And we do have one coming here at this hospital. I'm really pleased. So we've looked at the big three causes of transfusion issues and problems in the country now. It's not HIV. It's not HCV. It's bacterial contamination of platelets. We've kind of got a little handle on that with apheresis platelets. Trolley and TACO are still an issue. Yeah, we're recognizing it more, but it's complicated. These are sick patients. They have other lung injuries. Transfusion overload. Is it trolley? Is it transfusion overload? But it's certainly a problem. And ABO mismatches, a really intractable issue that continues to haunt us. But I think we're making some progress on that also. We've looked at technical innovations, pathogen inactivation, apheresis technologies, mail-only plasma for getting around trolley, staff education, transfusion safety officer. Those are all good things. What about artificial blood? Is that the answer? Is there something we can find that will replace blood? And this has been kind of in the lay press. It's been out there as a holy grail for years and years. Let's replace blood. Well, we can't obviously replace blood. Excuse me. A better term for artificial blood in our community would be red cell substitute or artificial oxygen carrier. We're obviously not replacing blood. So it's artificial oxygen carrier or red cell substitute. Where are we with that? Well, there are lots of applications for this product if we can get it off the launching pad. Clearly, an acute blood loss, a artificial blood substitute would be great help. And we're talking here now in an ambulance, in a medevac helicopter, or in the battlefield, right? I mean, the military is very interested. That's an old photo. But they've been very interested, currently interested, in getting something, even used in Iraq, where they can have something immediately available in a corpsman's sack and pull out and transfuse. No ABO, no incompatibility issues. We need this. It would be very useful. There are other uses, too. For the transfusion, blood substitute, a red cell substitute would help us. Jehovah's Witnesses who refuse certain types of transfusions may accept certain substitutes. People with multiple red cell antibodies that are hard to transfuse, sickles, rare blood types. There have been some work looking at the anti-ischemic effects of these products to use quickly in MIs and sickle cell crises and strokes. If the material can be developed cheaply enough, maybe in areas that are underserved, that don't have good blood banks and refrigeration, can use these materials. And ex vivo organ and tissue perfusion. There's a lot of good uses for them if we can make them use, if we can bring them to clinical use. So there are definite pros. No ABO issues. There's no membranes. It's gone. No ABO issues. No HLA antibodies because there's no plasma. They can be treated robustly with like solvent detergent treatment, inactivating viruses and other pathogens. So no infectious risk. They have a long shelf life, and they can be immediately available. Well, what's not to like? Well, there are problems. They, and we'll see this in a little more detail, most of them have a very limited in vivo half-life, hours to a couple days at most. So they're very temporizing. They don't replace this 120-day lifespan of a red cell or a 60-day mean lifespan of a unit of blood, hours instead of 60 days. And do they actually work? Do they exchange oxygen where you need it at the capillaries? We'll look at that in a bit. They're going to be costly because there's been over $1 billion invested in research here so far, and there are some of them that are fairly toxic. There are two major categories of red cell substitutes that have been explored. One is a chemical, perfluorocarbons. You can make it by the tank car load. It's no problem with supply. It's a chemical. Perfluorocarbons dissolve a lot of oxygen. That's their plus. We'll look at that. And here's one of the perfluorocarbon companies, Oxygent. And here, if you can see it, this bottle of perfluorocarbon is actually, it's an emulsion, looks like a bottle of milk. It's white, it's emulsified. The emulsification is a problem, both manufacturing and transfusion, actually. But there you have it. The other major category, it's really not a blood substitute, because these are products actually manufactured from hemoglobin, human hemoglobin, or cow hemoglobin. I think we'd all prefer human hemoglobin, but there's not a lot around. A lot of cow hemoglobin, but there are issues with that too. Perfluorocarbons, there are a lot of different kind of permutations of this basic carbon and fluoride ring. You can see the different permutations that different corporations have tried. These are some of the names. And all of them have had some problems. You might be familiar, though, with this photo that was on the cover of Nature magazine, I think a number of years ago. Here's some poor lab rat suspended in this material, breathing away, lungs full of this stuff, breathing this perfluorocarbon product and surviving. Maybe not too happy, but surviving. So this looked very promising. But if you look at the physiology of perfluorocarbons, it really don't work too well. We have evolved, as you all know, just a marvelous oxygen dissociation curve that just works beautifully, picking up oxygen at the oxygen tensions of the lung and releasing it as we get down to the capillaries. Well, plasma doesn't dissolve any oxygen, and perfluorocarbons really don't dissolve a lot more. So what you have to do, if this is going to work, people have to really be on 100% oxygen or very high oxygen inspiration. So it really limits its use. There's really not a lot of oxygen, or not a lot of oxygen around to deliver at the place we need it. So right now, perfluorocarbons, I don't think there's any in active trials. I don't think that's really going to be going anywhere. So let's look at the hemoglobin-based products. Well, why can't we just use plain hemoglobin? Just get rid of the red cells and infuse hemoglobin. Well, many years ago, as I'm sure you're all aware, that was shown to be a non-starter, very toxic. The hemoglobin molecule dissociates rapidly, highly vasoconstrictive, major kidney and organ damage. It doesn't work. So hemoglobin, you just can't take and infuse. So the company's been looking at ways to stabilize hemoglobin in such a way that prevents its dissociation and reduces its vasoconstrictivity. And there's been the first generation of products were looked at alpha-alpha linkage, the cross-linking of the alpha-alpha portion of the molecule. And Baxter and others poured in hundreds of millions of dollars at this. Because it looked promising, but it didn't work. Matter of fact, it not only didn't work, the trials were bordering on disastrous in that the control, the treated people did much worse than control. The reverse of what you want to see. So these trials were stopped in mid-course, and that product was abandoned. Other companies now, many have looked at polymerized hemoglobin, polymerizing hemoglobin with glutaraldehyde or raffinose, looking at ways that you can link these molecules together in various chains. And as we'll see, there's been some progress here, but some disappointments also. There seem to be less toxic effects, but barely equivalent to whole blood, and increased cardiac events with these patients. So the last product is, the last family of products are conjugated hemoglobins, where the molecule is coated, if you will, with products like polyethylene glycol, making a big molecule. It's hydrophilic. It seems, as we'll see in the oxygen dissociation curves in a minute, that this molecule, which is more avid for oxygen, may actually deliver oxygen more effectively in the periphery. So if we look at the good old normal curve, the first generation products tried to mimic the normal curve and actually moved the curve a bit to the right, thinking it's better to kind of release these oxygen molecules quickly. Here's for good old perfluorocarbon. Well, it seems that these polymerized products were too effective, if you will, releasing oxygen too quickly at the precapillary level, causing vasoconstriction and organ damage because your precapillary arterioles clamped down. The pegylated hemoglobin is looking at it the other way, moving the curve to the left, a little more avid, seems to be counterintuitively allowing oxygen release more at the capillary levels, and at least in their phase two trials, look somewhat promising. So if we look at these different products in 2007, where are we with artificial blood? And sadly, the field is not very encouraging that we're going to see much coming down the road. A lot has been learned. It's been a great physiologic trip, but we haven't resulted in a licensed product yet, at least here in the United States. We've seen the perfluorocarbons are all on hold or discontinued because of ineffectiveness or safety. Cross-linked hemoglobins, as we've mentioned, were not a starter at all. All were discontinued because of safety. I've highlighted two companies that are still in business with polymerized hemoglobin. Northfield has a glutaraldehyde human hemoglobin. They just finished their phase three trials. Somewhat disappointing. Not a major, certainly not an improvement, and their products seem to be, when you look at an equivalent to blood, less effective, greater 30-day mortality. So it doesn't look, I would not think that the FDA is going to go ahead and license something like this. We'll see. Interestingly, another talk, but this was a trauma trial, so they had to get this special consent, trauma patients, this is a community consent, that you could either get this material or not in an ambulance, and you didn't have any say about it. And that caused a lot of interesting IRB and ethical issues, another story. Hemopure is a cow blood company, and the FDA Advisory Committee on Blood Safety and Availability just recommended that they do not proceed with phase two trials because of safety issues in their phase two. This company is the only material in the world that's licensed for human use. In South Africa, you can get cow blood if you're in South Africa. Not many people have, but that's the only licensed product. BioPure does have a veterinary product here in the U.S., so you can get cow blood for your dog here in the U.S., but you can't get it for yourself. The other last company standing is Sangart, they're making this pegylated human hemoglobin. They're entering phase 3 trials in Europe in an orthopedic antihypertensive trial, and we'll see how that turns out. So in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, blood banking now has moved a lot from just being a laboratory into a very complex field in infectious disease, therapeutic apheresis, perfluoric carbons, artificial blood, pathogen inactivation. It's a lot more than just your blood bank. We've looked at issues of blood donation. We've reviewed issues with transfusion-transmitted diseases, like looking at how HIV and HIV or HCV are not a problem, and these are minor problems, but we're addressing them. Blood, I think, I want to make sure that people walk away from this room understanding that blood today is very, very safe. As a medical intervention, it's one of the safest things we can do. Apheresis technology is advanced. I want to see all of our donors in 10 years going on machines. It's a good thing. We'll be able to really target our blood donations that way. And we've looked at transfusion safety in the hospital. A little review of trolley and taco, an understanding of ABO errors and their importance, and the opportunity that a transfusion safety officer can help us address this. And we've seen the progress, or lack thereof, with artificial blood. So there's been technology. There's been progress on some artificial blood and other innovations, but there have been roadblocks. Bottom line is we still need blood donors. We need human blood donors. It's not going to change. We have a shortage today in this hospital. Please donate blood. Ask your patients to donate blood. Ask your families to donate blood. It really is the gift of life, folks. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. For-